brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia. Jim Warren and Bob Relling founded the West Coast Computer Fair in 1977. The first edition, held at San Francisco's Civic Auditorium in Brooks Hall, featured momentous moments such as the introduction of the Apple II and Commodore PET computers. During a banquet held on the Saturday night of the first fair, Professor Henry Tropp presented the 1940s, the first personal computer era. Following Professor Tropp's passing, he arranged for the donation of this lecture and a number of his other papers to the museum in 2016.
Last night, John Whitney brought a delightful marriage between computer graphics and music, and it reminded me of a story that Grace Hopper told me in one of our interviews. And it had to do with the period when they were building BINAC. Most of you are familiar with the name John Mauchly, who is one of the co-inventors of the supposedly first general-purpose electronic computer, ENIAC, along with J. Presper Eckert. And when John and Press left the Moore School, where they had built ENIAC, they formed, in 1946, a corporation which eventually became the Eckert-Mauchly Corporation. In 1947, they signed a contract with Northrop to build a computer which became known by the acronym of BINAC. BINAC, not because it was binary, but because it was two computers parallel. No way to build an internal checking, so the thing they did was say, okay, we'll build these two computers in parallel. It had acoustic delay line memory, and as long as they match each other along, we'll assume the results are okay. Anytime they don't, we'll stop. And BINAC somehow, I think originally in the original contract, was supposed to be airborne in the Snark missile. acoustic delay light at all. But this musical thing of Grace's, she says, we ran BINAC day and night because it was going away. And they really wanted to learn from BINAC so they could build their next device, which became the UNIVAC 1. And we wanted to make the best possible use of it. We could, and I have a vivid picture in my mind, she said, of coming in early one morning. I'd gone home to sleep that night and finding BINAC surrounded by Coke bottles and sitting at it, slightly unshaven, John Mauchly. And both John Mauchly and BINAC singing, Merrily We Roll Along. And I thought of another musical story that I unfortunately wish I had the tape here, but one of the things I inherited lots of little things at the Smithsonian. There was a very famous and very popular television show in the 50s, The Arthur Godfrey Show. And one of the objects that auditioned for The Arthur Godfrey Show was a thing called the IBM 701, their first production scientific calculator. And the recording that I have is not BINAC clanking away, but I'm sorry, the 701, but playing Sousa March, or a portion of one, and the Marines hymn in its audition for the show, which I guess was turned down. It didn't make it. But there are many things that I'd like to comment on. I keep thinking about last night's sessions, and one of the things that Jim talked about that struck me about the early period was the way people communicated with each other. He put it very nicely in one of the in his journal, Dr. Dobbs, that it appeared to be an era, and it truly was, where people communicated with each other. They stood around on each other's shoulders instead of walking on their feet. And I think one of the speakers last night, John Whitney, said essentially the same thing, that it's very important in this beginning personal computing era that people talk to each other. And as he put it, don't make the mistakes that people have been making for the last 35 years. I think Fred Grunberger has an article on that in the current Datamation. One of the questions that was asked last night, and I think it was asked of Frederick Pohl, was by a gentleman who said, you know, I've been reading science fiction for 35 years. Why didn't I read about computers? And Frederick Pohl answered truthfully that they were there, but they were called by different things. In fact, I have a copy of a science fiction story from about 1927, from probably Fantastic Stories, where there is an honest-to-goodness computer. But they were called different things. They were called engines, or as Ed Berkeley used to call them, giant brains, because computers weren't things. Computers were people. Rex Rice, who joined Northrop in about 1947, said, yeah, we had a bunch of computers. They were a whole battery, 40 or 50 young ladies who had their Marchants and Friedens, and they solved their engineering problems. George Stibitz, whom I want to talk about later, at Bell Laboratories in the 30s, said, yeah, we had our computers. We had these young ladies who did our calculations for us on the circuit design problems that we were interested in. And so computers probably didn't come to be called an object, at least in the dictionary sense, probably until the 1950s sometime there. It's been a change in the word, and so I wouldn't expect it to show up in the literature. We're talking about, Jim asked me to try to draw analogies. Personal computers, I think of a person doing his thing at home. And this occurred in the early era. George Stibitz, who's one of my very favorite people, was a gentleman who got his PhD in mathematics probably 1929, 1930, went to Bell Laboratories on West Avenue in New York City as a research mathematician, but primarily working on circuit design. And, of course, telephone equipment consisted of relays. And so, as George tells the story, one night in 1937, he was sitting around his kitchen table, and he got to thinking about relays, and he got to thinking about arithmetic. He went out to his garage, and he got about a foot square piece of plywood, and he mounted some relays on it and probably some bulbs from an old flashlight or old flashlights. And he realized that he could do arithmetic in the binary mode. Essentially, he was able to add one-digit binary numbers. At that point in the conversation, I stopped him and I said, wait a minute, Professor Stibitz, what made you think binary? And he said, well, I had studied Boolean algebra from Crystal's algebra. And I later on got my copy of Crystal's algebra out, which was published in 1893. And sure enough, on page 187, there's a section on Boolean algebra. And anyway, George took this little mounted board, this one-digit adder, to Bell Laboratories, showed it to Sam Alexander and a few of the engineers, and he said, you know, we ought to be able to do the stuff our computers are doing mechanically. And they looked at it, and they said, you know, that's a pretty good idea. So they started designing circuits. And when they finished in 1939, they had what was called the complex calculator. And the complex calculator was really a very interesting device. It added, subtracted, multiplied, and divided complex numbers. And it later became known as the Bell Mod 1. It operated out of the laboratory. They kept it in a closet. They kept it in a closet because they didn't want people messing with it. They locked the door of the closet, and they gave keys to the maintenance men and the janitors. And if you wanted to do a problem on the complex calculator, you went to a teletype terminal, which they had three scattered around, and if nobody else was on it, then you could get your problem solved. The following year, they decided to demonstrate this thing at the Mathematical Society's annual summer meeting, which was being held in Dartmouth College that year at Hanover, New Hampshire, which is some distance from New York City, and they originally planned for Stibitz to give a talk, and they were going to move take the calculator out of its closet, move it up to the lecture hall, and about July or maybe late June, Sam said, I don't want to move that thing. George, rewrite your talk, because all we're going to do is going to put a teletype terminal in the hall. You describe how this thing works and let everybody play with it. And that's precisely what they did. They had not only remote terminals in the building, but they had a remote terminal from Hanover, New Hampshire to New York City. John Mauchly happened to be at that meeting, and he remembered a minor incident, which is not significant historically, but he was in the hall one day, so there was a lecture going on that he didn't understand, and so he wandered out, and there was the teletype terminal and a funny-looking little man doing stuff on it. And he was getting madder, and the obscenities kept getting worse, and he was kind of kicking this terminal and stomping away. And finally, John walked up to him, and he said, what's the problem? And the gentleman replied, oh, I can't get the bloody thing or blankety-blank thing to divide by zero. And with that, he walked away. And John turned to somebody, and he said, who is that weird gentleman? He said, oh, that's Norbert Wiener. And so I'll take John's word for it that happened. Let me tell you, this is a brand new story, one I've never used before, if I haven't forgotten my notes. It's an interview I did with Professor Stibitz, and it's another home calculator, or something that started in the home. By the way, that 1937 one-digit thing was later renamed. Bell went on to build a whole series of relay calculators for World War II, relay interpolators and various devices to do ballistics calculations, including some very sophisticated, very general-purpose things called the Bell Mod 5 and Mod 6. And so historically, they renamed that 1937 object as the Mod K, K for kitchen. Anyway, George Stibitz was involved in a project that nobody knows about because it never got completed. During the war, he was a member of the National Defense Research Council, the NDRC, which was a group formed under Vannevar Bush to provide scientific assistance to the war effort. And one of the members of that committee was a man named Duncan Stewart, who was the president of the Barber Coleman Company, which is a company located in Rockford, Illinois. And so Duncan Stewart and Stibitz got to know each other through these meetings. And shortly after the war, Stewart thought it'd be a nice idea to try to build a computer. Barber Coleman just might be interested in this. And so these are Stibitz's words. The design started as a toy. Using a small magnetic disc and recorder, which I built in the basement, and a few vacuum tubes. The scheme was to read digit by digit from the discs, perform a numerical operation with vacuum tubes, re-record digit by digit on the discs, and then transfer the recorded values as we needed them. It was binary, of course. This is in 1946. And Duncan Stewart was very much interested. And so they started designing, the engineers, a man named Ralph Schutte, and they began designing. And by 1948, they had two prototypes, which he describes. And I don't know that I want to go into the details of that, but the interesting thing about that is that once they got the prototypes working and they set their standards, they wanted something small. Oh, roughly from Jim to the end of the table would be almost too large. They wanted the price low. $20,000 was an upper bound. They wanted to keep the tube count small. And so anyway, they did a market survey. And I think one of the comments on the market survey was rather interesting. They went around to various companies who had scientific or mechanical type calculations, design problems essentially, machine tool designing, grinding machine problems and so on, gear design. And the comment that Professor Stibitz made about one of the companies said, we talked to Honeywell and got the usual response. First place, it couldn't be done. Second place, they weren't interested. Third place, they had already done it themselves. which really kind of blew my mind, because this almost characterizes the early period of the computer industry. I want to go back or back off a little bit and just kind of think back 30 years. I picked 30 years ago because Jim was kind enough to let me participate in an ACM 30th anniversary. They were founded in 1947, and the first meeting, Herb Grosch was in attendance, was held across the street from the main entrance to Columbia University, or an auditorium there. And it was November, December of that year. There were 80 people present or so. Rough count, about as accurate as the count you gave just a few minutes ago. And about half of them signed on. There was great resistance to it, but anyway, 1947 was the year in which it was founding. How many computers were running in 1947? Well, we know officially of only one electronic computer. That's ENIAC. It was running in 1945 when it did a problem for Los Alamos, officially dedicated in the summer of 1946. So it has a birthday in one of those 2 years, depending on what you consider official. The patent, I guess, was filed in 1947. There was also a thing in England that we are just learning about, although there have been indications that the English had an electronic device called Colossus that was used primarily for cryptanalytic work, and it was operative in December of 1943. And since there were about 12 Colossi built by the end of World War II, I assume some of them might still have been running in 1947, but I don't know. All of that is still classified. It really is. It's kind of mind-blowing. Brian, when I was in Washington, I remember 1972, I got a letter from Brian Randall, who's in England and has done this marvelous source book of selected papers. And Brian wrote, and he said, "We both know that there was this thing going on and that there was an American counterpart. I can't seem to get any place. Why don't you try at your end, try to get the American thing, because of the close cooperation between the British and the Americans. And so I called a gentleman who was on my advisory committee, Rudy Winokur, who was the chief historian for the Secretary of Defense and had worked very closely with presidents and secretaries of state for some 20-odd years. And I said, "Hey, Rudy, I need help. What can you find out about cryptanalytic stuff that might have used electronics? I know there was some stuff going on in NCR by Joe Desch and Bob Mumma, and there were some other pockets. What can you find out?" Well, a few weeks later, Rudy called me, and he said, "Hank, stop asking questions." And I said, "Why? Am I going to get in trouble with the CIA or something?" And he said, No. But the more questions you ask, the deeper the answers go. And about the same time, I received a letter from Brian Randall, which contained a photocopy of a letter from Prime Minister Heath, which said, "Thank you for your inquiry. It's a fascinating set of questions you've asked me, but unfortunately, there's no way I'm going to answer." But a little bit has begun to surface. In December of 75, the British did release some of the technical characteristics of Colossus. But anyway, 1947, electronically, that's pretty much it. There had been some things built. I mentioned Joe Desch and Bob Mumma. They built a device for National Cash Register in either 1939 or 40, still in existence. It could add, subtract, multiply, and divide at something approaching electronic speeds. It had tubes and stuff in it. And NCR said, "Gee, who's interested?" And it began to gather dust until recent antitrust litigation. There were a couple of gentlemen who built a device. I think it could only do two arithmetic operations at IBM about the same time, and they got pretty much the same response. So electronically, in 1947, there are those Howard Aiken's Massive, this great big 63-foot shaft down the middle of it, Harvard Mark I, the automatic sequence control calculator, had been running since 1944, and he was about to finish the Mark II. In England, there were three projects just beginning, one at Manchester under the direction of somebody named Williams and another gentleman named Kilburn, one at the National Physical Laboratory under the direction of a gentleman named Alan Turing, and one which ended up probably being the first what we call von Neumann machine that actually ran under Morris Wilkes, who had come to the United States he thinks by accident. Nobody knows yet why he was invited to a summer program at the Moore School. And during this summer program, he was shown ENIAC and how it ran. Now, ENIAC was kind of a monster machine, but it had did a lot of good work. It had large memory, 20 words, 18,000 vacuum tubes. Well, when you stop to think about it, you know, before the transistor, I guess what we call 10,000 words of memory would have filled a large room. And you know what, it's kind of a fingernail size now. But anyway, there were the Bell machines. There were four of them by then. And that's pretty much the state of the world. People are talking about these calculating devices, but nobody really knows where they can get one. Census Bureau is saying, gee, we ought to have one of these things. Where can we buy one? University of Illinois, somebody said, gee, you know, I'm a mathematician. I'd like to have one of these things. Where can we buy one? People at Oak Ridge, Argonne, Rand, all over the country, the aircraft corporations in 47 are saying, gee, we got some problems and we'd like to solve them. Let's go buy a computer. Well, there aren't any to be had in 1947. Another interesting event in 1947, the date is December 23rd. The object stood about this high, I guess that's about 2 inches, perhaps half an inch in one dimension, 3/4 of an inch in another, called the transistor. Nobody knew what its properties were, but they knew it was interesting. And every time they tried to check for properties, it never behaved the same as it had the time before. But they kept playing with it. By 1949, you could buy these things for about $15 a piece, keep them as though they were a valuable jewel, lock them up in the safe at night, but you never knew how they were going to behave the next day. George Danzig published a procedure for linear programming in that year called the simplex method. A very interesting project was going on at MIT in 47. In 1944, they had decided to try to build an aircraft simulator, an analog device, which might help not only in the training of pilots, shorten the training period, but perhaps in the future design of aircraft. Well, by 1946, they were beginning to fight with the Navy Department because they didn't really want to build one of these. By 1947, they had finally got the Navy to say, okay, you don't have to build it. You can go ahead with this other thing called a whatever we call it now, a computer. And so something started which we now know as the Whirlwind Project. And it was on the Whirlwind Project that a gentleman named Jay Forrester developed something that later became known as coincident core memory. So 1947 is really kind of an interesting year.
We'll conclude Harry Tropp's The 1940s, the First Personal Computer Era, in our next episode.
From the archives of the Computer History Museum is drawn from the audio holdings of the Computer History Museum. It is produced by curator Christopher J. Garcia. Music is by John Plute.
Thanks for listening.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.